We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on with my wonderful co-host, Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. we're talking about an episode today that I chose because I finally wanted to get, I guess, some level of completion when it comes to episodes. So I went all the way to the beginning and I chose season one, episode one, which is not really the beginning, right?
No, it's not really.
But according to Amazon Prime,
it is. Yeah.
And Amazon Prime is kind of like they're the new leaders of truth. So we're going to call this season one, episode one. But the other ones are, of course, the ones by Raymond Burr. And I think there are other specials. So I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, we're going to be covering a number of different topics coming here. It originally aired on November 29th, 1987. And it brings us down to Michigan, Hillside, Michigan, back in 1980, right in the dead of summer.
Oh, yeah, July 23rd. And we meet a couple who's been married for less than a year. In fact, they haven't even known each other a full year. Dave and Sharon Davis. And they are getting ready to go horseback riding.
Wait, is it Sharon or Shannon?
Shannon. Sorry, Shannon.
You know, it's weird. Shannon's one of those names, too. It could be a male or a female. That's in my experiences anyway. But so, yeah, Dave and Shannon Davis, Dave Davis. I mean, come on. It's almost like you're a 1950s record producer or a DJ or something like that. What's very strange about them being married is that they really kind of rushed into it, right?
Yeah, they were married less than 8 weeks after they met, and they're kind of an odd couple. Like, he's, I think, 10 years older than her. She is the heir to the Moore's Brother Bottling Company, which bottled like soda, like in glass bottles, soda in Toledo, Ohio. And he's kind of like a smooth talking, fast talking kind of dude. Shannon and Dave are visiting a friend and they rode their horses over there and they're riding their horses back home from their friend slash neighbor's house. Shannon is described as not a very experienced horseback rider. And Dave says that on the ride home, Shannon lost control of her horse and she was thrown and she hit her head on a rock. She was thrown so hard that her shoes and socks were like blown off of her and her shirt was unbuttoned. So,
which is all, of course, extremely strange. It is very crazy that, you know, of course, if you fall from a horse, you can absolutely bang your head and be damaged pretty terribly. But what is your take on all of this? I mean, it seems to be extremely crazy from the very beginning. Dave, I think, is a completely shady guy. But Shannon's family does seem to like Dave.
Yeah, Shannon's family likes him at first, and so, you know, she's rushed off to the hospital, and she is pronounced dead there, and Dave is, like, really kind of pushing that Shannon be cremated, and Shannon's dad says,
too much.
Yeah, and Shannon's dad said, no, we want her to be buried and not cremated. Now, at this point, both of her parents noted that he had scratch marks all over his arms. He said it was due to like low-hanging branches when they were horseback riding, but it could be from somebody fighting back. So he asked them to like float him the money to give her a funeral because he said he was broke.
Well, wouldn't they be able to determine like by taking her nails and seeing if there's skin cells on and stuff?
I mean, not if you just think it's a horseback riding. I mean, that was just their first little red flag. But like you said, they liked him. So there was no reason to really look into it further until all these other red flags come up.
I just think with an autopsy and everything, it's one of those things that you probably would do. I mean, if you scratch somebody to actually make a mark, I would imagine that the person doing the autopsy examines the entire body and would see that her nails have some form of trauma to them. I don't know.
It's 1980. It's rural Michigan,
that's
you know,
true. That's
and,
true.
And
that's
she's
true.
Supposedly to have been thrown from a horse. Last time she was seen, she was on a horse. So I don't think anybody had any reason to doubt him.
So
he's begging the parents for money. They float him the money to give her a funeral. And Shannon's dad's like, didn't you have life insurance on her? And Dave's like, no. Oh, gosh, no, I never had life insurance on her. And this is when Shannon's mom gets really suspicious because she remembers Shannon telling her that he took out like a huge life insurance policy on their honeymoon. Mm. There was a big court battle and the parents won the right to bury her in Toledo, Ohio, instead of having her cremated in Michigan. So she was buried 3 days later. And they say, you know, Dave was unemotional at the funeral, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. People express, you know, things in different ways. But they realize he's a liar because he claimed to be an orphan, but his mom, dad, and stepdad all showed up to the funeral.
How crazy is that? So this is like, you know, so-and-so, and all of a sudden, his whole family shows up.
Yeah, and they start, like, comparing stories, and they talk about how Dave told Shannon's parents that he was wounded in Vietnam, and Dave's parents are like, oh, he never even served in Vietnam.
But let me ask you, so do you think Shannon was in on the lie, though? Because if they even know that Shannon died, and they're coming to the funeral, they must have known about her.
I mean, I have no idea. I don't know where the parents were from. It could have been a long-distance thing. Maybe he was telling his parents one thing and telling her another. I don't think Shannon had any idea that this was going on. Keep in mind, she was like 10 years younger than him. It was her newlywed husband. I mean, you're not getting any more idealized than that.
Yeah, that's true. I just wonder if Shannon's parents were kind of a bit much. And it was kind of like maybe it was just a distancing thing. Like, I want nothing to do with your family because they're nuts.
Interesting. Or the other way around, too.
So.
Well, something shady that did happen, like, immediately after the funeral is that Dave hops on a plane with his new girlfriend and takes a trip to Florida. And keep in mind that Shannon had died 3 days before the funeral.
Yeah, this is extremely, extremely shady. And yeah. Do they mention that in Unsolved Mysteries? I don't think so.
No, that's something I dug up. Yeah. But so apparently, because Dave's, like, has his roommate holding his mail or has a buddy holding his mail while he's off gallivanting in Florida, the roommate discovers that 6 different insurance companies are trying to get Shannon's death certificate just to prove that she died so they could pay him out the $330,000 that he took out on her, which today is $1.03 million.
So this is crazy. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, even insurance companies must see like kind of a bit of a red flag.
Oh, yeah, you would think so. I would definitely hope so. It turns out there's a newspaper article. The newspaper's called Detroit Free Press, and they uncover that Dave was involved in, like, insurance scams, fires, fake injuries, all that kind of stuff. So Shannon's parents are like, let's take another look at this death. So they exhume her body, and the medical examiner says, yeah, she definitely fell from the horse, but we noticed that she had an unknown drug in her system.
Mm-hmm.
So during all this time,
which I've never heard of this drug. I mean, this is not a naturally occurring drug. This isn't a type of thing that happens over, you know, sometimes you can take a drug and it can create another drug in your system. But this was an actual foreign drug, right?
Yeah. And it's later found out to be succinylcholine. And the death was still ruled an accident. So Dave moves to Florida. We put Detective Don Brooks on the case.
Dun, dun, dun.
And he reached out to Dr. Robert B. Forney Jr. And they have no idea what the drug can be. And because Dave Davis is a farmer with large animals, they contact a veterinarian and asked if maybe his animals had been given any kind of drugs. And so the veterinarian suggested that it's probably like a horse tranquilizer. And the horse tranquilizer matched the succinylcholine in her system. So they did some digging around, found that Dave was at a hunting camp once where they would use horse tranquilizer to hunt deer.
Yeah, I didn't know this was a thing. This is crazy.
No.
No, yeah. I'm wondering, if somebody's listening and they can even shed some light on this, do they shoot the deer with the drug and then kill them later? Or is this a way of killing them more humanely? Or is psychopaths taking these animals and torturing them or something?
I just assumed it slowed them down so that they could kill them more accurately, you know? Hmm. But I don't know. I did not do any research into how to kill a deer with a bow and arrow and a horse tranquilizer. So
I did a little bit. But, I mean, back in the 90s, there was a drug called Special K, which was ketamine. Mm-hmm. And it was totally a veterinarian type thing. And people would take it, and it was exactly that. It was a very heavy dose of a form of tranquilizer.
Yeah, I've definitely heard of it on my fair share of Law and Order Special Victims Unit. So.
In your glow stick days. I'm kidding.
Exactly.
I think it's way before you. Thankfully, it's before your time. You didn't. You weren't a victim of the large baggy pants that 90-pound girls would wear.
Exactly. The only Special K I have is in my breakfast cereal. So.
Crunch, crunch. All right.
Shannon was sadly exhumed again, the second time she's exhumed.
Did they ever check the fingernails?
As far as I could tell, no. But jeez. They found that there were two injection marks, one on her shoulder and one on her wrist. So on October 13th of 1981... a grand jury issues a murder warrant on Dave Davis. So what they said on Unsolved Mysteries, which is a little different from what they said in trial, was that Dave and Shannon went riding on the horses. Dave pushed Shannon off, injected her with a tranquilizer, and then he bashed her head with a rock. What they said in trial was that on the day Shannon died, David suggested that they have sex outdoors. And Shannon was like, okay, so she was getting undressed. He snuck up on her and gave her like two shots of the succinylcholine to immobilize her. And she fought back before the drug took effect. No. And then he bashed her with a rock and she ultimately died of suffocation from her lungs being paralyzed from the drug.
We've seen this in movies where you run up to somebody and give them a shot and press the plunger.
Mm-hmm.
How realistic is that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just not sure. I just didn't know if you knew anything about that. Is that a realistic scenario?
What I'm picturing is, okay, keep in mind they are newlyweds, yes. And they got this new house, nice rural area, so I'm not ruling, like, sex on the side of the woods off limits. But I'm picturing she turned around, started taking her clothes off. Bam, he stabs her in the shoulder. She turns around like, what was that? Did something just sting me? And then he just like keeps stabbing her with it, basically.
Kinky, yeah.
Well, it's, I guess, but while you're injecting her. And then apparently there was like only one rock around this whole area because Dave had actually run back to their friend's house that they had just come from and was like, come quick, help Shannon. So they both ride off to get Shannon. And they said that there was just one rock where there shouldn't have been any rocks, and it was, like, covered in blood. So the chance that she would have just fallen and hit her head on this one rock in the woods is pretty preposterous.
When I was looking at it, it was slightly different when I was thinking about the scenario in the event that I would ever do something like this, which I don't think I would. Don't think I would. I would probably give the person the tranquilizer first or right before they're getting on the horse. And then go riding and let them naturally fall off and maybe clock them over the head if need be.
Yeah, but how are you sneaking that tranquilizer into them?
This is where I would have gone the route of she was a junkie or something like that. But, you know, of course, it didn't go that route. This is all my, you know, made up, you know, Dimension B type of thing. But I was very surprised that Dave didn't say that flat out, well, she had a lot of issues and we struggled with a lot of things. Or just exactly. Making a comment like that, it's so open-ended that, and it could be interpreted in so many different ways.
Where and anything just to blame take the blame. Exactly. Anything to take the blame off himself.
Or get her drunk. You know what I mean? There's so many different things that could have happened or making this a little bit more smooth, I guess. But maybe Dave isn't the smoothest guy in the world.
Well, he's pretty smooth because we do get an update that he is living in American Samoa in the South Pacific, married to a 23-year-old named Maria. But the FBI swooped in and arrested him in January of 1989. He was going by the name David Meyer Bell, and he worked as a pilot for a small airplane.
Who filmed the Samoan footage, do you think?
I don't know. She was not too pleased, though.
She was like, she had the face on where it's like you order a meal and you're waiting like 25 minutes.
Yeah, she was like, if you could just get out of my house, please.
Right, right. No, I don't want more bread. You know, it's one of those type of faces. And I was kind of, there's a lot of times where Unsolved Mysteries will have footage that, where the hell did it come from? How does this exist? And it's always relatively production level footage.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, yeah.
It's so strange to me. Like, it's possible, I guess, where it's like, we're going to bust this guy. Here's a tip. Jump on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I mean, if you have the money, right? It's just...
Yeah. And there was news crew surrounding this whole thing, because when he comes back in the airport, he's like cuffed and they're like, David, did you kill your wife? Did you kill your wife? And he's like smirking from ear to ear. And he's like, no, I didn't. I didn't do it.
I didn't do it.
In like the most Hawaiian shirt. Like he's just like dad on vacation.
Right. Looking, it's like so. A guy in an up. He's like an extra in the movie Cocktails with Tom Cruise or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And that looks like the lifestyle he was leading, like a Hunter S. Thompson type of Rum Diaries scenario, where he's just kind of with this like 23-year-old native girl, and he's just living the life. And I just thought she looked way young. That was my
thing.
It was very, was very eerie and creepy from my point of view.
I totally agree. And so in December of 1989, actually, he was found guilty of first-degree murder and received life without parole. And in November of 2014, he died after 25 years in prison.
Yeah. The whole thing was pretty dramatic at the end that he was caught. The parents seemed to have some level of closure.
Yeah, the mom was like, we want the death penalty, but... Yeah. Sadly, the mom died in 2008. Shannon's dad died in 2012. But there is more media on this if you're interested. There's a book called Murderous Intent, which was written about this case, and a made-for-TV movie called Victim of Love. Not the one with Pierce Brosnan, another Victim
of
Love.
That's the first one that came up when I Googled it.
Me too.
And, I was like, wow, I wonder if Pierce Brosnan went down to like Costa Rica or wherever he was. I can
picture. Pierce Brosnan does have Unsolved Mysteries ties because his wife is Keely Shea Smith from Thanks, Bob.
Yes,
you know, that lady.
Yes.
Yeah, that's her.
You didn't like that.
It's not this. No, not at all.
I don't like this casualness that you guys seem to have in this fake office.
Not for me. Not for me. But we do have another story that completely doesn't fit in here. This is an update from a previous story. So like we usually do, I suggest...
Yeah, this one is, I even stated, I think it's a bit of a non-story, but it's a nice closure story.
Yeah, so this guy, George Marsh, died alone in his nursing home in Kansas in 1982. He left behind a ton of money, and now they're trying to find his heirs. So they show pictures of the heirs, like, that were left in his possessions, and they find his niece, Eleanor Toler, and she talks to you, Unsolved Mysteries, about, like, seeing her picture on TV, and the family... lives in Rock Springs, Wyoming. They're like, we don't know why he kind of decided to break with the family, but we've been looking for him since 1931. And they say they just want to bring his story back to, or his body back to the family burial site, and that they're going to divide the money up among his relatives. And that's
it. I mean, I thought it was nice that they brought him to, like, I guess the family cemetery or plot. Yeah. He's got easily one of the larger tombstones there. So it's not like they just said, just give us a cheap tombstone and throw it on there. They actually spent some money on his burial.
Yeah, it wasn't just like, just give us the check. He died alone, but we wanted his money. That's what I thought it was going to be. So I was like, I don't like this, but it wasn't. It was nice.
I'm not related to these people, definitely, because my family would have been like, what else you got? You got anything smaller? A little bit more? He wouldn't have liked that. No, but... So, yeah, I mean, I think it is nice. They're a bit older. It seems like the living part of the family is a little bit older. And it just seemed nice. I thought it was a nice closure. Nice.
But it was weird because even in the beginning, Robert Stack introduces this as like all married couple stories involving death. And this one out of nowhere. So we know it's like an Amazon edit where they put it in. I mean, but
no twins in this episode, though.
No, thankfully, because they're all married.
But creepy.
We do have a unexplained death.
Yeah, I felt bad about this one.
Me too.
The victim's name is Eileen. She seems like a regular like lady who lives down the street who's super nice, who like maybe you don't talk to too much, but during Christmas time she leaves you cookies. And this is the reality of my neighborhood. And it's, you know, she just does seem really nice. And we get a view of her house and it seems like a very comfy house. And if, the reenactment, of course, but I got this whole vibe of like, this is a really just normal person.
Yeah, me too. I wrote on our shared Google Docs that she just looks like she has the best macaroni and cheese. Like, I want to go to her house. Like,
she puts the breadcrumbs on top and then.
Love her. Love Aileen. So on April 29th, 1986, around 11 a.m., an Oklahoma farmer notices all this smoke billowing up from this, like, dark country road. So he calls the authorities, and the Oklahoma Highway Patrol arrived on scene.
Yeah.
Now, they said that the burning car had actually melted into the guardrail. That's how hot it was. But I know you had something to say about
that. Yeah, I just, you know, these guardrails, they're pretty thick. They're thicker than cars. and they're always banged up. You always see them kind of banged up. But they're made of serious steel. Like, you know, this is like industrial steel. And, you know, they're meant to last, like, probably decades. So to melt that, it would take about 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit of like real temperature, of real heat, you know, in like a furnace. And even to bend it, you're probably talking at like 2,500 degrees, where it gets like white hot. You know, you've seen like on a forge and all that kind of stuff. But a car engine will only get up to about 1,500 Fahrenheit. I mean, granted, if you have something in the car, I guess, and you could somehow create this magical furnace going on, you can melt things together, but even you're not even going to find very often anyway cars that will melt. Very often people do see things melted on cars, and it's plastic or the pleather that they use, or God knows what other kind of materials are in there, and there's a lot of aluminum, you know, that can melt. But so I just thought it was strange. It could have been just the appearance. Like, it could just been ugly and it appeared to be melted. But that being said, I think that it's to have this kind of fire happen is so strange.
Yeah, it was huge fire. And Lieutenant Larry Sally.
I'm sorry, Kim. I just had a total three military cars just drive by. Like,
I heard something going by.
Three of those like huge Hummers without the plates. Like, that looked like, you know, I could edit that out. It's just that was kind of, hopefully they didn't hit my car. All right. Well, welcome to the suburbs, military.
Well, speaking of that's crazy. But speaking of cars, Lieutenant Larry Sally tells us that there was a body in the car, and skid marks indicated that the car actually hit the guardrail going about 50 to 60 miles per hour.
Wow.
So they're able to run whatever they run, VIN or plates, and they identify the car as belonging to Pat Conway, who lived with his family in Lawton, Oklahoma. And if that sounds familiar, it's the same town of the Tina Creamer and Robert Miller murders that we did with the David Lee Kemp killer.
Crisscross.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, do we know what kind of car it was that Aileen had? Sorry.
Yeah, Aileen. No, I searched all over. I could not find it.
And I just by looking at it, and of course, it's the reenactment. It's either a Buick or a Cadillac, and I couldn't find any type of recalls. Because, you know, cars do go up in crazy fires. I mean, you ever see a Tesla fire? You know, if you ever want to watch something really crazy, is type in Tesla and fire in YouTube. And it's horrifying because, you know, a Tesla has those type of accelerants in the battery cell with the nickel, and it really does get to the point where the car is melting to the ground. But I just, I'm just really always curious about that. This came up in another story that we did a few episodes back where we talked about the cars and the recalls, I believe CO2, the carbon monoxide poisoning. So, yeah, I mean, I really think that sometimes, not all, in a rare situation, things like this can be explained away because your car has some type of recall.
And to be fair, OHP, Oklahoma Highway Patrol, does think it's a car crash, but Pat Conway, the husband, thinks that it is murder.
Yeah.
So
I would think so too. You know, because, and probably your spouse would think too, because our spouses love us. And it's like, there's no way.
You know, yeah,
you always look for something. But I feel really bad for Pat Conway.
I did too. when he arrived home, actually, a few hours after the accident, he noticed a couple things that were weird. The patio door was open. Aileen's purse was on the floor with her glasses and her driver's license in it. The iron was on. The hose was running. And the bathtub was full. And the phone was off the hook.
Yeah.
So there was it seems like if she did leave on her own accord, she kind of dropped everything.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, to the only thing here that I think is crazy is the leaving the iron on, and maybe the hose. But leaving an iron on, it's just one of those things where, you know, you do iron. It's like you don't even leave the room. At least I don't. Mm-hmm. I won't even leave an iron on if I'm leaving the room. So
yeah, but it's like an old 80s iron. Maybe it takes a while to heat up. So she was going to hop in the tub before. And so she took the phone off the hook because she didn't want to be disturbed when she was in the tub. And she was like letting the iron warm
up.
Has
iron technology really gotten that much better since 1980? Because it takes like 6 seconds or something.
Yeah.
No, it's possible. Let's not dismiss it. It's just she also seems to be doing a lot of stuff at once.
Let's
top off the pool. Let's iron, you know, Pat's shirt, and let's, you know, take a bath.
Yeah, she's a multitasker. But so Pat said that maybe she was trying to call the police and that's why the phone was off the hook. But at least in the reenactment, the phone was laid gingerly down by the bathtub. So if it was me, I'd be like, I am not getting any phone calls. I am taking a bath. And I would just take the phone off the hook.
It's always fancy to have that bathroom. I mean, to have the bathroom phone. Mm-hmm. When I was kid, whenever you're like, oh, you guys have a little bit of money, don't you?
The epitome of class. Yes. So Pat actually says they've never been to the area where her body was found, and he contacted investigator Ray Anderson. Now, I did a little digging on our buddy Ray Anderson, and I found out that he was later sentenced to 5 months of prison for embezzling $51,000.
I don't want to believe it.
Oh,
he just seems like a good guy.
Well, he takes the case, and he even says, like, I think this is just a grieving husband in denial. And they go to the crash site looking for clues a few days later. And Ray found this, like, church bulletin on the side of the road 200 feet from the bridge. And a church bulletin, if anybody doesn't know, is like, here's the songs we're going to sing today. Here's the recipe for Betty's apple pie. Like, it's like just like little housekeeping stuff, what the sermon's going to be about.
It's something to read. But I mean, I think we've seen these in memes a lot, and very often, I mean, I wonder, are they thinking that she was distracted or something?
Well, they were just saying like, it's so weird because she never rolled her windows down. So how did that get on the side of the road?
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's the only reason why they're even bringing it up. So Pat's like, that was definitely ours, and that was definitely in the car, which, I don't know. These are too many definitelys. I think, like I wrote on here, like, the average temperature in Lawton, Oklahoma, in April is 75 degrees. That's perfect window down weather if you're just cruising along. But also, how do you know for sure it was your bulletin? Like, there could have been at least, like, I'm thinking 20 in this little small town church that were passed out.
I don't know. I'm going to put myself in this category. You can drive around my neighborhood no matter what the weather, and the windows are 100% sealed. Especially if it is a Cadillac, it was one of those cars that prides itself on the fact that it's a silent, you know, it's soundproof. It's the sound system is really great. And, you know, it was a good filter system. So I don't know. I can't put that totally outside of the realm of the possibility. But I don't know. That's all. I'm just saying, if you drive around my town on the most beautiful day where you're like, it's 70 degrees and breezy and clear, everybody has their windows closed. That's all. I don't know. But at the same time, you're right. It's like kind of like it is a little bit strange, but I don't think it's that strange. That's all.
No, and I'm with you and I hear you. It's when somebody says, no, she always drove with the windows up, like never once did she roll the windows down. That's a little suspicious to me. And that doesn't mean there's not a first time for everything, too.
No, it's totally.
And just leaving that window open, because I genuinely have no idea what happened in this case.
Yeah, it was ruled from accidental to unexplained, I think, really to just kind of pacify Pat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the district attorney asked the FBI and the fire marshal to investigate the likelihood of arson. So we meet Sonny Sansom from the fire marshal office, and he says that the gas cap was missing.
Hmm.
So that's interesting, and because they were saying it burned at so dramatically at such a high temperature, like there had to have been some kind of accelerant used. So they did like testing on a similar car and similar car parts, where they're like trying to directly light dashboard covers and stuff like that on fire
and stuff. It's very strange.
Yeah, but the material is all flame retardant, so they weren't able to find anything.
Yeah, I just think it's all kind of strange anyway, because they're trying to light something with a blowtorch. You know, that's not like a normal thing. And also, we have to also think, was there anything else in the car?
Yeah.
It was her, you know. Is it possible she just kind of had a heart attack? A fire started. It's a road that's not very well traveled. And a little fire turned into a big fire?
I think, again, I don't know what happened, but there were skid marks, which indicates that she'd have to be braking.
Yeah, but if she had a heart attack or something something traumatic, or a bunny ran in front of her, you know, I just, the bottom line is we don't know what happened, you know, and that's the thing, and that's the sad fact, I guess, that we get to at the end there, because there's really not enough evidence to go one way or the other. But there is some strange stuff.
Yeah, and I would like to mention that we get to meet Paul Renfro, who's kind of a fan favorite of Unsolved Mysteries. He is actually he's appeared on the most different cases of Unsolved Mysteries. He's actually appeared in 4 different episodes, which is the most of any of their, like, law enforcement guests. So that's just kind of a fun fact.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, is that kind of like a well-known fact?
Yeah.
Okay. Is he still around?
Yep. Yep, I was looking him up today. And he actually, he's the State Bureau of Investigation spokesperson. So he is the front and center of a lot of these cases. And if I had to guess, I'd say he's probably the one contacting Unsolved Mysteries because he's from the State Bureau of Investigation. But he says there was like a lot of robberies in the area recently, and maybe she interrupted a burglary and jewelry was missing. So here's the thing. Robbers very, very rarely kill their victims. Her car was in the driveway. So that means if they went to go rob them, presumably somebody's home.
Yeah.
And there's easier ways to kill somebody than like driving them into a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't really buy that story. But, you know, Pat did eventually move on. He remarried in 1988. He died in 2013. And there's a lot of like random crazy theories out there, but nobody knows what happens. However, like 2 hours before we started recording this, I found an article from the Oklahoman that in 1987, just months after this case happened, another woman in Oklahoma was found burned in her car off a remote country road in rural Oklahoma. And the fire and the death were accidental, says Paul Renfro.
Yeah. Now, I'm not looking at Paul Renfro as a possible suspect. No, of course not. But it is just kind of crazy that 2 very similar things are happening.
Let's look into that.
That is very, very. See, this is what you do. You make me look at a particular segment like this where I'm like, whatever. It's nothing. And then you bring up these little facts. And this is the beauty of your research, is that all of a sudden I'm like, you know, let's talk about this, you know?
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you for saying that. And I think our goal for the podcast is like, we're just going to put all the information out there so you guys don't have to do the Google searching, but it does really bring up some interesting information.
Yeah. Now you tracked down that their kids, most of their kids are out there and seem to be leading normal lives.
Yeah. One of their kids died.
Yeah.
Yeah. They seem great and happy. And he seemed really happy with his new wife, because he did remarry. They had 7 kids together, him and Aileen. And so I found 5 of them on Facebook. Unfortunately, one of them died. But like you said, they're all just living their best lives.
Now, I do want to just mention that in your 1987 article, I noticed that they did reference the automobile that burned up, which was a 1979 Oldsmobile Cutlass. Now, this is a car that I actually know relatively well, and it's just not the kind of car that would catch on fire. Hmm. Like, it's a big engine, it's a very fast car, actually, when it's tuned properly, and just kind of strange. You know, it's you don't Oldsmobile doesn't. It's one of those cars that's considered for the time to be a little bit of a safer car, a little bit expensive. Not as expensive as a Cadillac, but still a very, very, you know, it was almost like a doctor's car or something. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, I just wanted to mention that. It was a very fast car, very solid car, but not a car that you would really kind of associate with this kind of fire.
Well, we're going to jump completely opposite because we're talking now about 1920s and we're talking about a lot of water instead of a lot of fire.
Glenn and Bessie Hyde.
Yeah. Oh, the best names. This was actually, you know, they'll do like missing, wanted, unexplained death. This one was called Mysterious Legends. I was like, ooh, that's a new one.
And this one is like, this is where our budget went.
Oh yeah. There was some real stunts going on here.
I have to wonder, and you know, one of my hopes and dreams is that people who are associated with the Unsolved Mysteries production would reach out to us and answer this question. Would you go on these trips? Would you, like, was it like an announcement where it's like, well, guess what, guys? In April, we're heading to the river, you know? And it's like you spend 3 days shooting or something like that, and it's just, it's got to be a party a little bit.
Oh, yeah. No, I think so, too. And it's the 80s. Everybody's having fun.
Yeah.
I think it's fun.
And if you did have any type of input or if you were a part of the production of Unsolved Mysteries, please reach out to us. I mean, we would love to hear from you.
And you could do that on our Facebook page, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast, or unsolvedmysteriesrewind@gmail.com.
I heard that it is the most listenable podcast in America right now.
You know, I've said that.
I say that all the time. All right, so back to 1928. We have two newlyweds, and they're set out to navigate the rapids. Horrifying to me. This is scary. You know, like whitewater rafting and everything. I think it's wonderful. I think this is your thing. It's your thing, and I love it.
I feel like this is something Jack would have liked us to do on our honeymoon.
Travel 26 days.
I definitely think so. I definitely think so. Right before our wedding, we had like a multiple day canoe kayak trip all down the river where we were camping and stuff like that. So this seems right up his alley.
Wow. Do you think that you guys would have, do you think Jack would have survived the trek?
I think Jack would have survived the trip. I think Jack would have packed a life jacket.
I mean, by your hands. I mean, if...
You know.
If you wanted to bail 26 days in and he's like, we're not going home.
Well, you know, no comment. No. They were actually married for like 6 months before they decided to go on this trip. Unsolved Mysteries, I'm sorry to say, it's usually flawless. They got a whole lot wrong in this story.
Yeah.
I cite Wikipedia and Charlie Project for a lot of the information here, but basically the last person to see Glenn and Bessie Hyde alive was Emery Kolb. So we fast forward 50 years later and authorities are like cleaning out his stuff because Emery died and they find a skeleton hidden in a canoe in his garage.
I feel like this is going to happen to me when like on Let Go or Offer Up when I'm like looking for like a synthesizer or something like that. It's like, yeah, come on over, check it out. And yeah, you can. I have a canoe for sale. And it's like, oh, let me take a look at your canoe. Yo, dude, there's a skeleton in here.
Oh, my God. Run. It's already too late for you.
Yeah,
at that point.
The clock and that's it.
Yep, exactly.
Our competitors got me.
Oh, no.
Tricked me with the synthesizer.
We get to meet kind of badass forensic anthropologist Dr. Walter H. Berkby. And he says that it's basically homicide or a suicide victim. And I don't know how many suicide victims end up in a canoe inside your garage. So a newspaper article posits that the bones could be of Glenn Hyde's because they determined that it was a man's bone and nobody has ever seen Glenn or Bessie since then. So Glenn was a 29-year-old. Unsolved Mysteries says he was 27. And Bessie, Unsolved Mysteries says, was 18, but she was actually 22.
Is there a reason, you think, for any of this? I mean, aside from the fact that Bessie was married at this young age, but 22 is young, too.
Yeah, 22 is pretty young, but, you know, they didn't have the resources that we have now, and they couldn't just look all this stuff up instantly and put it smugly on a podcast like I did.
Well, do you think that they looked at her picture and thought she looks 22? Because she doesn't.
No, she looks very young.
Oh, really? I went the opposite. I thought she looked much older than 18.
Interesting.
I mean, not 22.
Well, she has lived a life, and she was married. She actually got she is divorced one day after her divorce from her first husband. She marries Glenn, and they got married in Twin Falls, Idaho, in April of 1928.
A beautiful day. A beautiful sunny day. Spring wedding, really. So.
Yeah. Well, they build the boat themselves because Glenn wants to make a name for himself. So he's like, we're going to go on the most perilous river, the Colorado River, which runs through the Grand Canyon. We're going to go with my inexperienced young bride in a homemade boat without life jackets.
This is the period of time where they used to have like Time Life books where it's like, yeah, you can do your own plumbing. And I'm wondering if he got the book about like building boats. Because building a boat is a very involved situation. I mean, of course, we're not talking about fiberglass and all that stuff. But to get the wood to remain watertight, you have to bend it. There's all of these things that are involved. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm just saying it's not something that most people have that skill to do.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait for you to talk to Jack because Jack's actually doing this for his 40th birthday.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's building his own canoe, but yeah, it's all going to be out of wood and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know what? But here's the thing. This is just a little bit of a side thing. Is all right, Jack is a real man's man. From my point of view. And he seems to be the kind of guy where it's like, "Oh wow, I don't know how to do that. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to find a solution and I'm going to get an answer." And he really does seem like the kind of person, because I've asked him a couple of, things about fixing something. Yeah. Like that type of thing. Yeah. And I get a real answer. I don't get kind of like, if you go to Google and like, that's what I would do. But, I get a real answer. I get somebody who's knowledgeable in this. So yeah, I could see Jack doing that. And it's possible that this guy was that kind of guy. But not everyone's like that. That's all.
True. Very true. And yeah, no, I totally agree. He's like a man. But
I am a big fan of Jack.
Same. Me too. Well, this guy was kind of trying to set some records, and they said he was a thrill seeker. So for most of the story, we're introduced to John Thiboney, who tells us what's going on. He's a writer. But it took the Hydes 26 days to get from Twin Falls to Bright Angel Trail in the Grand Canyon, which is a brand new record. They stopped to visit Emery Kolb because they're trying to get some supplies. And he had navigated the river twice before, so they wanted to talk to him about his advice. He is a photographer, and he arrived at the Grand Canyon in 1902. So he actually took the pictures that you see of Glenn and Bessie Hyde. And he told them that they needed to either wait until winter was over or at least take his life jackets. And they were like, nah, we're cool. And they left his house on November 16th. And 2 days later, the couple disappeared. November 18th, 1928. They were never seen from again.
Yeah, this is very odd, very strange. Now, they just disappeared. I mean, and that's it. Like, nobody's ever reported ever seeing them again, right?
No, they've found their boat, and their boat was found at River Mile 237. Their final photo was taken around River Mile 165, but Bessie had written in her journal that they passed at least River Mile 231. So their boat was found, like, perfectly intact. Everything was in it, but there was no Glenn, there was no Bessie. So we get back to current day, and Dr. Berkby is looking at the skeleton, and he determines that it's a 20 to 30 year old male who was 6 feet tall with brown hair. And there was a .32 caliber bullet embedded in his skull from a gun that was at least first manufactured in 1902.
Now, here's the thing. If you're going to kill yourself, right, you could, of course, choose to kill yourself by shooting yourself in the head. A terrible, terrible thing. But do you find a canoe, lie down, and do it?
I mean,
maybe.
Well, I don't think so. And not to be callous, but that would totally ruin the canoe. Like, if you have a hole through it.
See, that's what I was thinking. But I'm wondering if the bullet went through the skull. Would it? A 32 would, I think.
Yeah, but back from the day in 1902, I don't know.
don't think. Well, you're right. I mean,
it's probably more powerful back then.
Just like alcohol.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is during the Prohibition, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he determined that the death would have occurred in the 1920s. So this was kind of cool. So Dr. Birkbe takes an image of Glenn and he kind of projects it over the skull to try and compare the bone structure. And while I agree it was creepy and it was not the most accurate way to determine something like that, it was pretty interesting.
It's interesting, I guess. And I don't know, there's something about it that I just feel that I don't know if you could just take a photograph of somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Without having several of them and really kind of use that to lay over a skull.
And, you know, maybe he did and we only saw a little bit from the reenactment. I don't know.
Also, was there ever a recovered gun?
No.
So he committed suicide and a gun. There's no gun. So he ditched the gun before dying. Or somebody found the body, some kid walking by. He's like, ooh, look, a free gun.
Ooh, look, a free body, and like takes it and puts it in a canoe. I don't know. But so some say Bessie's still alive because there's no.
Sorry, I'm hearing, ooh, look, a free body, put it in a canoe.
Well, Bessie is thought to be still alive, and she's like retracing the steps of her elevated honeymoon because in 1971, a woman named Elizabeth Cutler took a. Oh, yeah. She took a 20-day rafting trip through the canyon with, like, a bunch of other people.
I'm
like
Bessie Hyde.
Yeah, and I stabbed him. I stabbed him because he hit me. So they're, like, chilling at Diamond Camp where the boat was actually where they had last camped. And everyone's just kind of sitting around. It's near the end of the trip. There's a campfire. And she's like, I stabbed him because I didn't want to go on the trip.
It's
and
a campfire tale. That's all I think.
Exactly. And it turns out that she actually recanted the story. She was 4 inches taller than Bessie and 3 years younger than Bessie. And she has a birth certificate which shows that she was born as Elizabeth Cutler in Pomeroy, Ohio.
So take this as a lesson. Don't go telling stories about things while you're on a campfire because there's a rat among you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, jeez, they really took that really far.
Yeah, no, I thought so, too. And then everyone's contacting her, like, what's this? I heard that you murdered somebody. Like, that's a crazy story. So we do get a little tidbit from Wikipedia. In late 2008, a donation of photographs and documents to the Grand Canyon Museum collection led to the identification of the Kolb skeleton as that of an unidentified suicide victim who was found in the park in 1933.
Hmm.
So take that for what you will.
Yeah, it just feels to me like the entire investigation is so scattered. I don't know. I feel like maybe another body will show up.
I mean, what was he doing with it, you know?
Yeah.
It was so weird and not a good final resting place. Like, they literally showed his head was in like an old Folgers can.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I forgot about that. Actually, if you don't mind grabbing that as an image, we should use that on the cover.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, my. Yeah, and it's like a coffee can with a skull in it.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Crazy. Who did that?
Yeah, I don't know. And they're like, oh, he's just an eccentric man. But it's like, well, let's look a little deeper into him.
Right.
So now, speaking of eccentric and shady men, we're going to talk about missing person Dottie Kaler. Now, I got a whole lot of information from a Sun Gazette article called Dottie's Story by Joan Morris, and it was very thorough, and I would suggest checking that out because we don't have enough time to tell you the whole story. But
you know, I do want to just preface that Kim and I will watch these and we'll approach these situations with, of course, having our own opinions, but if we could figure a way that this person is not guilty, even though our guts are telling us that he may 100% be guilty, then we would definitely say that. But there's everything that points to Jewel Kaler as being somebody who may have been involved more, at least, in this situation than what we see here. It's just, the guy seems to have no soul.
Exactly.
And it's a little bit heartbreaking. The story is really a little bit heartbreaking because it seems as though he might have actually really loved Dottie at some point. Maybe.
Oof. Yeah.
And I can't even say that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We're going to have to put this whole story under a big umbrella of allegedly, like just to cover our butts. But there is so much shady stuff about him. And at the very least, he was an uncaring husband. And, you know, obviously suspicions are worse. But so Jewel Kaler is married to his wife, Dottie. He drops her off to catch a BART train in Pleasant Hill, California. And if you don't know what that is, BART is called Bay Area Rapid Transit. It's in the Bay Area of California, and it's basically like a monorail, mm-hmm. but it goes fast. It's just the train system.
It's like a modern train system.
Yeah. So his story is that she has agoraphobia, which is the fear of the outdoors, and she was testing herself by, like, taking public transit all by herself.
Which is awesome. I think, you know, agoraphobia is probably, it's not something that I deal with, but I can imagine having this fear, especially nowadays. And I feel as though, you know, she wasn't afraid of it. I mean, she was afraid of it, but she was taking the steps to possibly try to overcome her fears.
Yeah, she had a lot of anxiety going on. Anxiety does lead to agoraphobia. It can. And the only way to treat agoraphobia is through exposure therapy. So, like, kind of putting yourself in the situation that you're afraid of, which is a huge hurdle to overcome when you have anxiety.
And probably also when you're in an abusive relationship, because you're in your abusive element. So, like, you're in your safety space is actually an abusive space.
And I know.
I can't imagine being
tragic.
In that type of situation. It's just awful.
Yeah. So there's never been trace of her since he allegedly dropped her off at the BART station. Now, he comes on Unsolved Mysteries and says that she just appeared just to piss him off. And apparently he, like, kind of stepped out on him for over half of their marriage. So everyone just kind of thought she was getting even with him by disappearing on him. So to go back a little way, in 1973... Dottie married Jewel. Jewel is an entomologist, which is like a bug guy. Mm-hmm. When they first met, he actually lied to her and said that his name was Jim Rupp because he didn't want her to know that he was married with a 5-year-old daughter.
No, he's currently married with a 5-year, I mean, of course, with a 5-year daughter. But when he met her, he was married. He wasn't married in the past and divorced. He was currently married.
No, yeah, he was currently married. So he divorces his wife. They get married. They settle into Concord, California, and she almost never left her house. So Jewel was away on business over 50% of their marriage. And on Thanksgiving Day in 1981, they got into an argument.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, they got into an argument over a missing checkbook. The women at this organization that she belongs to called Women in Transition, which is actually a battered woman's, like, help center. They say that she told them he hit her with a board, and so she threatened to stab him with scissors.
Now, this is also, you know, I just, sorry to interrupt you, this is a woman who is, you know, seeking the help of, you know, a lot of self-help type of things, but also these type of group programs. I mean, this is somebody who is in distress, you know, and
like, God love her. She's trying her hardest.
I mean, it's anybody who could look at this and go, well, she was a sneak the way that maybe Jewel is pointing out that she is, right? From his point of view, it was really kind of she's leading the second life. And we will learn more about that in a moment. But it's just the reason she's leading a secret of life is to escape you.
Exactly. And to overcome, like you said, her safe space, that is her, like, hell space also. And she has to break out on her own. Like, she had just set up a P.O. box. She had just set up her own bank account. She was definitely showing signs of leaving him. But to get back to this fight real quick, Jewel says his side of the story was that she was just cussing at him, going off, and just grabbed scissors and threatened to stab him. So he hit her with a, quote, little typing stand. Now, when someone is missing, they're usually, like, idolized. People can't say enough good things about them. But men who do kill their wives, not saying Jewel did, but just saying men who do, usually bring up negative things about the wife to make her look less sympathetic. So pretty much the only time you hear a man talking negatively about his missing wife is when he had something to do with it. And he's describing her as an attacker, as a sneak, and all this kind of stuff. as someone who just wants to piss him off by disappearing. So she had been attending those Women in Transition meetings. She has two friends, Shelley Wilson and Paula Powers, who we do see on the show. And Jewel says, like, he wasn't even aware of her secret double life that she was leading, because she did get that bank account and she did get that P.O. box. So she actually also, because her and Jewel, it comes out later, were separating at the time, she had asked a friend to keep a filing cabinet for her at her house, which contained all the evidence of Jewel's past affairs and his shady activities. So 1 month before she disappeared, Dottie, Jewel got a transfer to Salt Lake City. And Dottie said, I won't go with him. Now, Jewel on Unsolved Mysteries says, and I was glad she wasn't coming.
Right.
Like, it's so cold. And let's remember, we've talked about this before, the most dangerous time for a woman in a domestic violence relationship is when she's planning to leave her abuser, because the control is, like, slipping away from
her. And it's something that we see come up over and over again on Unsolved Mysteries. It's just really something that I think if you're looking to move on from the current relationship you're in, even if you don't think it's that bad, but it's a little bit bad, you just have to really learn to cover your tracks. And it's what a scary and sad thing to have to tell somebody, right?
Exactly. I know. It's so tragic. It's so sad. But he decides to drop her off on July 12th. Because she wanted to go on, all of a sudden she wants to go on an overnight trip all by herself. So he dropped her off at the BART station. He got off work early the next day, took the BART home, and found Dottie's Volkswagen Bug parked next to his car at the BART
station. Let me just say something. What are the odds? I'm sorry. It's a 1971 Super Beetle. I used to own this identical car, color and everything. And it was the first VW Bug that I had that I really liked. And I've had a lot of them, but and just recently I bought another one that is to recreate my favorite Beetle, and it wasn't working, so I passed it along to a friend who's redoing it right now. But I just wanted to point out that's such a nice car, and it's just one of my favorite things, and it makes me like Dottie even more, because she has good taste in cars, and she could drive stick shift.
Yeah, well, I knew that you would find a kinship with her as soon as I saw it was a Volkswagen Bug, because I know you're a big Volkswagen Bug guy. Yeah. But so Jewel looks inside her car and sees her purse just sitting out there, which what woman just leaves her
nobody.
Purse visible in a car?
And it was unlocked. Nobody. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so it's crazy. So Jewel leaves a note on the car, which what are the odds that car would even be next to his car? But he leaves a note on the car asking her to contact him and just saying, like, I love you so much. I just want you to come back home. Now, he calls the police 5 days later.
I left five notes.
Yeah, exactly. And they said the notes were getting, like, increasingly more hostile. And he filed a missing persons report with the BART police. I had no idea BART had their own police.
Yeah,
that's so crazy.
Yeah.
I've ridden the BART.
So, well, I would imagine BART is similar to, like, the MTA here in New York, and MTA has their own police as well. It's like just a transit police type of situation.
But they can do all the things, like, could they file a missing persons report?
Yeah, they're police officers. Well, at least in MTA. MTA, they're a part of, they carry guns, everything. They are legitimate police officers, and they might even have separate holding stations.
Okay, interesting.
I even got a ticket from one once.
I've heard that story. So
oh, no, it's a different... shut up, Cam. No,
we got some more stuff to talk off mic, I guess.
No, I went over the tracks, and they claimed that I didn't wait until the lights were fully up. Mm. Like, we have the trains that kind of pass in front of you, and when the gate went up, I didn't wait until the lights went out, and they gave me a ticket. But I fought it.
That's lame. Well, that's not as juicy as the other story.
No, but I did get an MTA ticket. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, the BART police help him file this missing persons report, and they told the Concord Police Department. So 2 weeks later, Jewel's just moving on with his life. He moves to Salt Lake City, and Diane, who's Dottie's sister, hires private investigator Francie Kaler. And she's like, this is a 90% potential foul play situation. I don't believe that this is going to be a missing persons case.
Yeah.
So Jewel leaves Unsolved Mysteries saying, it was hell living with her. That whole problem is behind me, and things are really good in my life right now. Now, there's a thing called distancing language, which usually in like 911 call analysis, it goes to show someone's guilt by separating yourself from a situation. So by saying that whole problem instead of my wife's disappearance, it is very interesting to note. But I did break it down into a little more of a timeline with the new information I found. So in 1984, this is 6 months before Dottie went missing, Jewel got secretly engaged to a new girlfriend. Now, he told her, he like wrote in, you what?
No, I'm just, I said, life goes on. I can just hear him saying it, you know, you know what, his tonality. And I just don't want to judge him based on the way he looks or the way he sounds, his tonality and everything. He just seems guilty, but you know, I'm not going to judge him on that.
Jack said he sounded like Winnie the Pooh. Like that's how his
voice
sounded. Oh my
God, I have to listen again.
It's so perfect. But he told this woman, either he told her face to face or in a note, that he would make a Herculean effort to be with her, even kill for her. Now, 1985, 6 months later, Dottie and Jewel are separating and she is supposed to be keeping the house. However, as early as June 7th, before she started disappearing, he started filing paperwork with the city of Concord to have the house be able to be used as a rental property. Now, he gutted the entire house, repainted the interior, and allegedly poured a brand new concrete porch just before she disappeared. Yeah, so take that for what you will, but Dottie does disappear. In 1988, the court receives a letter that is an anonymous letter postmarked from Gary, Indiana. It says, quote, "To whom it may concern, Dottie was killed by her husband the morning she disappeared. It happened very early in the morning. He brought her to the garage and struck her with a tire iron. There was also a hand-drawn map of the diagram of the garage showing the car and blood stains. This letter also accuses Jewel of taking Dottie's body to a remote area of Concord where new homes were being built. And it says he dumped her body in a ravine and then kind of dug out a hole beneath the curving roots of a birch tree and shoved her body in there. So the document examiner compared writing on the map with known samples from Jewel and said that significant similarities exist between the two. Police have also developed a DNA profile on the stamp and the label of the envelope and says that they haven't matched it to anyone, but it was definitely a man who wrote the letter. In 1990s, Jewel meets his current life partner, and the two are still together today.
On Facebook.
In 2004, Jewel runs for Utah State Legislature.
Sounds this about right. I mean, this is, seems like the kind of past that you want a candidate to have, right?
Well, it's also this year that he is designated an official person of interest, and he quickly withdraws his bid for Utah State Legislature because all this comes out. So Diane Rusnak, who's Dottie's sister, files a lawsuit against Jewel to have Dottie declared legally dead and to have Diane be the sole executor of Dottie's estate.
Now, let me ask
because
you,
it went to Jewel.
Would that, does that mean that everything that she owned goes to this person?
Yes.
So that means everything, half of everything that Jewel had up to that point.
I don't know. Like assets, I think. Well, I guess if she's legally declared dead in 2004, then everything up to 2004 would be half hers. I really don't know how that works.
Yeah, me either. But I'm sure that it's one of those kind of crazy things, though, because, it must be, right? I mean, it's...
I don't know, but whatever happened there did lead to, in 2005... the home that they shared together, Dottie and Jewel, was searched and they dug up the entire concrete porch, but no evidence was found since 20 years have passed. And I can't help but feel like Diane getting all that was part of that since it was the house they owned together.
How do you get the right? I mean, what judge looks at this and goes, all right, you know what? Let's dig up the entire poured concrete porch. And to do all these things and then have it, you know, like a Geraldo Rivera moment where there's just nothing.
I know. Well, in 2005 is when the search warrant was issued. And there was a search warrant when he was also listed as the person of interest that had like 29 points of interest of why he was considered such a shady guy in this disappearance. And that was what finally got them okayed to search the house, was like all this stuff adding up against Jewel. Now, in 2020, you can find his Facebook. He has a pretty popular Facebook that's open, and a lot of people are trolling. We do not support the harassment of private individuals. No, but a lot of people are like, he'll post a picture of him and his wife, and people are like, where's Dottie? You killed her. And he, on every single one, is like, I am the victim here. She disappeared and framed me, and you should be feeling sorry for me and my family for everything that she put me through. So he is still singing the same song that he was singing on Unsolved Mysteries in 1987.
And Jules, if you're listening to this episode, please don't reach out to us. We have no interest in talking to you. No offense or anything, but it's just too creepy. But I think that he's getting off on that. I think that he enjoys this attention. He must.
He can't post anything on Facebook without 20 people saying that he killed his wife. And it's not that hard to make your profile private, even if you are
just
kind of
close it down. It's just a matter of he probably has no real friends. So
yeah, exactly. But he does have a girlfriend who he is still with and has been with from the 90s.
Watch your back.
So. Yeah.
I'd say, I would just say for her, good luck.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, again, we're not. Legally, there's nothing we could say one way or the other. There's no evidence. There's no physical evidence to state that he did anything. No, but
he's a free person.
But just like we're free people, he's just creepy. And something's off there. And I'm really hoping that something comes out in the future and links him to that. But if it's true, of course.
And if it does, we'll be updating you guys.
Yeah, definitely. But Kim, thank you so much. We get to the end of this episode, and I found that this particular story is such a kind of a classic Unsolved Mysteries segment because it kind of sticks with you a little bit, right?
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
I mean, it went public. The story did get bigger. The stuff you dug up, which is, I would say that Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, is the only podcast that's really putting this all together in the way that we're doing it. So
yeah, I think so. I hope so. We work hard for you guys, but it's also really fun for us to kind of dig through all this stuff.
Absolutely. So if you do enjoy Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, please feel free to leave us a review. 5 stars, nothing less.
Yeah. rate and review. Follow us on Facebook, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast. Or, like we said before, you can get in touch with us, not Jewel, but you can get in touch with us on UnsolvedMysteriesRewind@gmail.com.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.